Thanks. So I'm going to begin by reviewing the spinner formalism for helicity amplitudes, although you've actually got the experts here, and very likely most of you are familiar with the material already. So in four dimensions, the Lorentz group SO31, if we complexify it, splits up as SL2 times SL2. So a vector is in fact in the 1/2, 1/2 representation. So if we're given a vector P mu, we can convert it to an object PAA dot. A vector, therefore, is a tensor product of 1/2, 0 with 0, 1/2, the two spinner representations. And I'll write a spinner of one kind or the other as lambda A or lambda tilde A dot, where A and A dot are the two kinds of spinner indices and run from 1 to 2. So the fact that the vector is 1/2, 1/2 means that a momentum vector P mu can be written as PAA dot, an object with one spinner index of each kind, which we do simply by contracting P mu with the sigma matrices, where the sigma matrices are the chiral part of the Dirac gamma matrices. In a basis where the two kinds of spinners are the upper and lower components, the gamma matrices are block diagonal, and the off-diagonal block is what I've called sigma mu. So in a common representation, sigma mu is 1 and the Pauli spin matrices. And if we pick that representation, then we discover that P mu is the determinant of PAA dot. For example, if we take a momentum vector in the z direction, so if P mu is in the z direction, then PAA dot, I won't assume it's light-like, will just look like so. So its determinant would be e squared minus p squared, which is P mu P mu, where my signature is plus minus minus minus. So we see, therefore, that P mu is light-like, which means that P mu P mu equals 0, if and only if the determinant of the corresponding matrix is 0. Well, PAA dot is a 2x2 matrix. Its determinant is 0 if and only if its rank is less than 2, which means no bigger than 1. So that's true if and only if PAA dot has rank at most 1, in which case we can write it as lambda times lambda tilde, where lambda and lambda tilde are spinners of the opposite kind. Now, obviously, if I tell you lambda and lambda tilde, you know P, but the reverse isn't true, because once P is given, we're still free to rescale T, or lambda, I mean, as long as we make the opposite rescaling of lambda tilde, where T is a non-zero complex number. One more good thing to know about spinners is that for one of these spinners of type 1/2, 0, there's no metric in the sense of a symmetric invariant tensor, but there's an anti-symmetric invariant tensor, namely the Levi-Civita tensors, epsilon AB and epsilon A dot B dot, where AB and A dot B dot run from 1 to 2. Epsilon AB is anti-symmetric, and likewise epsilon A dot B dot. So those are the invariant anti-symmetric tensors of SL2. So the natural inner product we can make, given two spinners of, we'll say, positive chirality, is made by contracting with the epsilon symbol. The epsilon symbol is also used to raise and lower indices. So later on, I won't be very careful sometimes. My indices will be up or down. They've been raised and lowered with the epsilon symbol. And similarly, for two spinners of the opposite chirality, we define the inner product, the anti-symmetric inner product using this epsilon symbol by the square bracket of lambda tilde prime. Now, why have I taken the trouble of introducing the lambdas? Well, we want to study scattering amplitudes. And actually, there'll be scattering amplitudes of massless particles. And if our particles were spin zero, we wouldn't need the lambdas. For example, consider a four-particle scattering amplitude where the particles are scalars, therefore they have momenta p1, p2, p3, and p4. The only kinematic invariants are s, which is 2p1.p2, and t, which is 2p1.p4. And we could also define u, but s plus t plus u is 0. And then the scattering amplitude, well, it conserves momentum. And all this multiplies a function of s and t, which in the conformally invariant case would be a function of the ratio s over t. But in general, it's a function of s and t. So there was no need to introduce the lambdas. That was fine, the way it was. However, if we consider particles with spin, we'd have a bit of trouble. For example, let's consider a scattering of fermions. So the helicity is plus or minus a half. Well, each particle still has a momentum, but that doesn't fully characterize the initial and final state. The initial and final state has a wave function, a C number solution of the Dirac equation with that momentum. And to get a number from the scattering amplitude, we need to provide those wave functions. So let's ask what those wave functions look like. We'll just write down the Dirac equation, which for one of the chiralities looks like this. So I look for a solution in momentum space. So psi a should be a to a times e to the I p dot x. And then the equation comes out to be that sigma mu a dot p mu times a to a should be 0. Well, we've decided to write sigma mu a dot, that's p a dot, which we're writing as lambda a, lambda tilde a dot. So in momentum space, our equation becomes lambda a to a times lambda tilde a dot is 0. And that tells us that up to a scaling, the wave function is lambda. See, the slightly compact notation is maybe hiding the fact that by Bose statistics, the contraction of lambda with itself is 0, since it was defined to be like so, and vanishes because the inner product epsilon is anti-symmetric. So the wave function of an external particle is a choice of lambda if it has one chirality, or a choice of lambda tilde if it has the other chirality. So let's say if this has helicity half and this has helicity minus half, two more halves and minus halves, well, for each particle, we have to pick a lambda or a lambda tilde, that being the external wave functions. And then the scattering amplitude is, of course, linear in each of the external wave functions, and otherwise it's a function of the momenta. However, since the momenta can themselves be written in terms of lambdas, we can describe it in a more unified way by saying that the amplitude is really, well, first of all, a delta function of energy momentum conservation. But to get in the habit, we're going to write that in terms of lambdas instead of the momenta. And then it multiplies a function of lambdas and lambda tildes And this function obeys the following property. For each I, no sum over I here, for each particle, under the scaling of lambda and lambda tilde, A transforms with definite weight. And that weight, with the convention I'm using here, is just the helicity of the ith particle times A. Oh, sorry, 2 times the helicity. Because if the helicity is 1/2, the wave function is lambda, which has weight 1. If the helicity is -1/2, the wave function is lambda tilde, that has weight -1. And everything else is a function of momenta, which has weight 0. So overall, the most simple way to describe it is that the wave function, the amplitude, is a function of lambda and lambda tilde, which for each variable is homogeneous of the degree that depends on the helicity. Now, I've only explained that formula for helicity 0/2 and -1/2, but it's actually true for all values of the helicity. In thinking about this talk, I wasn't completely sure whether I wanted to explain that, but maybe I'll explain it for helicity 1. Well, probably I should, because we'll mostly be talking about helicity 1 and -1. So the standard recipe in textbooks is that each external gauge particle has a polarization vector, and the scattering amplitude is linear in each of the polarization vectors, and of course otherwise it depends on the momenta. That's a little inconvenient because the polarization vectors are subject to gauge invariance. And because of that ambiguity under gauge invariance and the lack of any canonical way to pick epsilon, it's very hard to get a simple formula. So, as you've probably heard in lectures at the Collider workshop earlier on, and as I'll be reviewing a little bit more later, the scattering amplitudes turn out to have, in many cases, very simple properties that would be hard to convey in the complicated formulas you get if you actually write them down in terms of polarization vectors like textbooks tell you to. Of course, again, you've got the experts here who have done much of this and have probably explained most of it to you. The most convenient thing to do from our point of view is just to write epsilon in terms of lambda. And, for example, for helicity plus 1, our formula says that the amplitude, I don't think I can summarize what I've just said. There are seats in the front. I'd recommend using some of them. There are as many free seats as people, roughly. So, our formula says that if the helicity is 1, the amplitude should scale under this operation with degree 2. So, that suggests, you see, if you just give me a P, there's no way to pick, well, that suggests that it should be possible to write a formula for a polarization vector of helicity 1 that would scale like lambda squared. The formula is actually the following. Epsilon AA dot of plus helicity is lambda A times mu tilde A dot over the inner product of lambda tilde and mu tilde, where mu tilde A dot is anything that's not a multiple of lambda, tilde. So there are two things I should show. One is that it scales with degree 2, and secondly, that the choice of mu didn't matter. It scales with degree 2 because it's got lambda in the numerator and lambda tilde in the denominator. So that agrees with our formula. And The choice of mu doesn't matter, because since mu lives in a two-dimensional space, any change in mu is alpha times itself plus beta times lambda tilde. We decided that mu tilde was not a multiple of lambda tilde, so they're a basis of the two-dimensional space, and any change in mu is a linear combination of those basis vectors. Since the formula is homogeneous in mu tilde of degree zero, the alpha term doesn't contribute. And as for the beta term, the denominator is invariant when we add to mu tilde a multiple of lambda tilde. And if we make that transformation in the numerator, you see that the change in epsilon is proportional to lambda lambda tilde, which is P A A dot. And that's a gauge transformation. So up to a gauge transformation, we wrote a formula for the helicity plus one polarization vector that was of degree two in lambda, in accordance with the formula. I didn't actually prove it had helicity one. You do that by taking this epsilon and that momentum, calculating F mu nu, the Maxwell field strength, and showing it was self-dual, which I'll leave as an exercise. Of course, there's a corresponding formula for negative helicity. We just exchanged the roles of lambda and lambda tilde. Now we pick a mu, which has the same chirality as lambda, but is not proportional to lambda. We write this formula. It scales with homogeneity minus 2, and it has the opposite helicity. So for our purposes, we'll take that as a sufficient explanation of this formula, although the formula is actually true for all helicities. And I guess we could have tried to explain it in a more uniform way that was good for all helicities. Any questions? To at least briefly recapitulate this for our friends who arrived late, we started with the fact that the Lorentz group SO31 complexified as SL2 times SL2. So a vector is the tensor product of the two kinds of spinners. And so given a vector P mu, we define the corresponding P AA dot, one spinner index of each kind, by using the gamma matrices, or the chiral part of the gamma matrices, sigma mu AA dot. Then we discover that a vector is massless if and only if the corresponding 2x2 matrix, PAA dot, has zero determinant. So a massless vector has to have, the corresponding matrix has rank 1. A 2x2 matrix of zero determinant has rank 1. So it's lambda times lambda tilde for some spinners, lambda and lambda tilde. And then it turns out that it's a much better idea to write scattering amplitudes of massless particles in terms of the lambdas rather than in terms of the momenta. Well, the first reason it's a much better idea is that you can do it. Because once the lambdas are picked, you can pick wave functions for the external particles, which enables you to write scattering amplitudes. While given only the momenta, you would have no way to write wave functions, and therefore no way to define scattering amplitudes. So that's one reason that this is a good idea, but there are lots of other reasons, which you've hopefully heard about from Bernd, Dixon, and Kossauer, who are all here and have done such nice things with it. Now, we want to study gauge theory scattering amplitudes. And we're really going to look at it at tree level. So we consider tree level Yang-Mills scattering with n gluons. And one good thing to remember is that tree-level Feynman diagrams are planar in a Hoeff sense. So as far as the color flow is concerned, or in a dual string theory we might discover, we have a disk with n gluons attached to the boundary in some cyclic order. So if we label the gluons in cyclic order, the group theory factor will be the trace of the generators, T1, T2, up to Tn. I'm not going to keep writing that factor. We're going to write the cyclic amplitude with the color factor omitted. So it's going to be a function of the lambdas and lambda tildes. And, well, since it'll give a good illustration of what we want, I want to explain the simplest example, which is the so-called maximal helicity violating amplitude, originally guessed by Park and Taylor and proved by Behrens and Gill. So, well, we have got all these external particles. We label them by helicity. And one interesting fact is that if the helicities are all plus, the amplitude vanishes. In supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, that's true to all orders by a supersymmetric Ward identity. At tree level, the amplitude in the pure gauge theory is the same as it would be in the supersymmetric theory. Because if all external particles are gluons, then the internal particles are also gluons, and you don't know whether the theory is supersymmetric or not. And of course, the amplitude with all external minuses is likewise zero. The next case is the case with one minus, and again it's zero, and actually the vanishing can again be interpreted in terms of a supersymmetric Ward identity. Although, well, there are other explanations of these vanishings, and the story I'm explaining today actually leads to an alternative way of thinking about it, although we perhaps won't quite get there. I forgot to say that when we label these diagrams to make crossing symmetry manifest, we think of all the particles as being incoming. An incoming particle is equivalent under crossing symmetry to an outgoing particle of opposite helicity. So in real space, this amplitude, if it wasn't zero, and as it isn't in pure gauge theory when you get to loops, it describes a situation where all internal incoming particles have plus helicity and all outgoing particles have minus helicity. So this amplitude would describe complete helicity reversal for all particles, but at tree level it's zero. Now this would be the next lowest helicity reversal, but it's also zero. So the next one is the first one that's non-zero, and it's called maximal helicity violating because it violates the helicity as much as possible. I'm really bringing still more coals to Newcastle because, well, I don't know how precisely this audience overlaps with previous ones, but I'm sure much more than this has been explained in other talks. Anyway, the amplitudes where you completely reverse the helicity vanish, but an amplitude where all incoming particles are plus and all outgoing particles except two are minus is non-zero. And this is that so-called MHV or maximal helicity violating amplitude. It's given by this beautiful formula that was guessed by Park and Taylor based on some examples and proved by Behrens and Gill. Well, there's a constant and there's a Yang-Mills coupling. There's a delta function that we're being good spirits and writing it in terms of lambdas. And then the amazing property of this amplitude is that it's only a function of the lambdas and not the lambda tildes. And it is, in fact, given by this simple holomorphic function of the lambdas. Where the denominator makes sense because the external particles have a definite cyclic order. So for every particle I, there's a nearest neighbor on the right, I plus 1. Well, let's check that this formula has the right homogeneity, which unfortunately got erased. The general formula says that the scattering amplitude there's a small inconsistency in my conventions, which I'm going to correct right now by putting in a minus sign. So the which will actually agree with the ones used in perturbative QCD and also in my paper. So the scattering amplitudes are supposed to be homogeneous in lambda of degree 2 or minus 2, depending on the helicity. Well, for most of the particles, I wrote an amplitude where the two which have minus helicity are A and B, which can be arbitrary points along the chain. So if we now consider a gluon that is not A or B, its corresponding lambda only appears in the denominator, where it appears twice, so the homogeneity is minus 2. If, however, I is equal to A or B, the corresponding lambda appears 4 times in the numerator, so the homogeneity is 4 minus 2, or plus 2. And that agrees with our formula, which says that the homogeneity should be 2 or minus 2, depending on the sign of the helicity. This function here is usually described as being a holomorphic function of the lambdas. What that means is the following. Physically, we're interested in real momenta in Minkowski space. But as usual, in discussing scattering amplitudes, it's useful to make an analytic continuation to complex momenta. I've implicitly made such a continuation. Now, let's discuss what it means in terms of the lambdas. In terms of the lambdas, P being real means that lambda tilde is plus or minus the complex conjugate of lambda, where the sign depends on whether the particle is incoming or outgoing. But we have not taken lambda tilde to be the complex conjugate of lambda, so we've made the analytic continuation to complex momenta. However, if we evaluated this formula for real momenta, we'd be interpreting lambda tilde as lambda bar, and then we'd say that this was a holomorphic function of the lambdas. There's the corresponding amplitude, I won't write it, with almost all minuses, which is given by exchanging lambda and lambda tilde. So that one with real momenta in Minkowski space would be given by an anti-holomorphic function. Any questions? Up to phases. And there's no natural way to fix the phases. The phases depend on the phase of the external wave functions. And for particle helicity 1, you could pick a wave function. Right. What's that? I would question whether there's any correct definition of the invariant amplitude. That's, how should I put it? There's no correct way to talk about the amplitude without, while suppressing its phase. There are probably... Well, if you wish to not be on shell, then the amplitude, first of all, you have to explain a gauge and all that. Then it would depend on an arbitrary vector epsilon. So since epsilon is an arbitrary vector, an issue of a phase wouldn't enter. Of course, the story simplifies and becomes gauge invariant on shell, and then on shell, if you fix the helicities, which by far leads to the simplest story, the wave functions are determined up to phases. But there's no way to eliminate those phases. I could have discussed it more carefully at the beginning, but I didn't want to save time. But not, well, first of all, there's no Lorentz invariant way to pick a wave function for a spinning particle. There's no Lorentz invariant way to pick that phase, so in that sense, there's no natural way. There's even a topological obstruction. There's a non-trivial complex line bundle that comes in. So topologically, there's not even a continuous way to pick a phase as a function of the amplitude. It's really best to not claim that there is a distinguished amplitude that depends on the labels, plus or minus, and the momenta. That's really fundamentally wrong. The amplitude depends on the phases you pick for the wave functions, and there's no natural choice. It's best to write the amplitudes in terms of an arbitrary choice of the wave function. And that's what this is. If you have what you like as a choice of the wave function, you can use it and get your amplitude. But this is the wave function. This is the amplitude written without having picked a particular wave function. Well, okay, we picked it and called it lambda. But except for calling it lambda, we didn't do anything else by way of choosing it.
But there it's clear, but if I run the tide of one to go to the form of agent brain upper,
yes.
The central gear is washed out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good point, I guess, but I have to think about what operation it corresponds to, of going from the S matrix to matrix elements of gauge invariant operators. But you're correct, certainly, that if we think of such an operation, we won't have to pick the wave functions. The problem will be to figure out what the operation is. We could find something. So, but for the scattering amplitudes, there's nothing, this is the, I would claim that this is the pure invariant way to say it. The wave functions do depend on phases which cannot be specified in any natural fashion for the external states. And the most natural way to describe the amplitudes is to describe them for an arbitrary set of external wave functions, as I've done. Yes, okay. For massive particles, instead of a helicity, we'd be picking a vector in a representation of SU2. And I don't think I know an equally elegant way to do it. Any other questions? Okay. Well,
is there a deep significance that this stuff only works in three-dimensional dimensions?
I don't know. A lot of things are special to 3+1 dimensions. So it would be reckless to claim that some of them didn't have a deep significance. This is tied to the possibility of self-duality, among other things. It's because we use the fact, among other things, that the spin states of a photon were naturally characterized by representations of SO2. And because the vector of SO2 is actually reducible over the complex numbers, you can decompose in a Lorentz invariant fashion into self-dual or anti-self-dual, or positive or negative helicity. So everything, well, the possibility of this stuff is a cousin of the fact that there are such a thing as self-dual Yang-Mills equations. So there are lots of things special, all kinds of things are special to four dimensions, and they tend to be closely related to each other. And it would be reckless to claim that they aren't fundamental. I haven't really said anything that's even close to being new, but by way of getting into something that is new, perhaps we'll ask the following question. Let's prove that this MHV amplitude is conformally invariant. It must be because it's the scattering amplitude at tree level of Yang-Mills theory, which is a conformally invariant classical field theory. But let's verify conformal invariance. So we need to write down the generators of the conformal group. So some of them are obvious. For example, the Lorentz generators, well, remember the Lorentz group is SL2 times SL2. And here are the Lorentz generators. That's half of them, and here's the other half. And then there's the momentum. I'm, of course, writing down one-particle generators. For a multi-particle system, you sum over all the particles. Well, what is the momentum in terms of the lambda? Well, that's how we define the lambdas. The momentum is lambda times lambda tilde. And then we should write down the dilatation operator. And here we remember that the momentum has dimension 1, which suggests that lambda and lambda tilde should have dimension 1/2. Now, we could try shifting. For example, take lambda have dimension 2/3 and lambda tilde have dimension 1/3. But that just corresponds to adding to D a multiple of this constraint operator. Since we're going to impose that constraint anyway, we may as well define D symmetrically to be 1/2 lambda d by d lambda plus lambda tilde d by d lambda tilde. Except we have to remember that we could add to D a constant that wouldn't change how it commutes with lambda and lambda tilde. And for reasons I'll tell you in a moment, I take that constant to be 1. The other generators of the conformal group are the special conformal generators, KAA dot. And of course, K has dimension minus 1. And the only object in the game that has negative dimension is D body lambda and D body lambda tilde, which have dimension minus 1/2. So the most obvious way to make dimension 1 with the Lorentz quantum numbers of K is a second order differential operator. So we try it. It's the most obvious thing to try. And we find that the algebra closes on the conformal group, conformally algebra, if and only if that constant is 1. See, the conformal algebra says, among other things, schematically, that K with P is D plus J. There's no way to add a constant to P or K, so they're uniquely determined. When we commute them, we find out exactly what D has to be, and we learn that we need the 1. Yes. In a sense, we're going to do that. So David is suggesting writing it this way. That's true. That would get rid of the 1, and in a sense, that's what we're about to do. Okay. So that's a representation of the conformal group, and let's see that it's a symmetry of the amplitude. So, for example, Lorentz invariance is manifest, and momentum conservation is clear because of the delta function. For brevity, I'll just verify invariance under D. We'll skip K. So we just need to calculate the total dimension of this thing and show that it overall has dimension 0. This piece here, the delta function, has dimension minus 4. Since lambdas have dimension 1/2, the numerator actually has dimension plus 4. In the denominator, each lambda appears twice. And since lambda has dimension 1/2, the denominator would have dimension minus 1 for each variable. But that's canceled by this plus 1. So the amplitude comes out to be conformally invariant, which is a nice check that we haven't made a mistake, but which we expected because it's known to be the scattering amplitude in Yang-Mills theory, which is a conformally invariant classical theory. So that's so far so good, but it's a very funny representation of the conformal algebra. Some generators act geometrically by first-order differential operators. A first-order differential operator is an infinitesimal symmetry of a space. So some of these are symmetries of lambda, lambda tilde space, but P is a multiplication operator, and K is a second-order differential operator. We can convert this peculiar-looking representation of the conformal group to a much more simple one if we make a simple Fourier transform. We change the representation of the conformal group, interpreting lambda tilde as a differential operator with respect to a new variable, mu, instead of a multiplication operator. And then we write d body lambda tilde as mu, or maybe it's minus mu, I guess. And the dilatation operator, for example, now becomes lambda d by d lambda minus mu d by d mu. The 1 disappears exactly as we just did with the lambda tildes. All that's happened, though, is that now lambda tilde is written as mu. Ah, I don't want to tilde here. Okay. Lambda tilde is written as mu and d by d lambda well, this has been rewritten like that. And likewise, P becomes lambda d by d mu, and K becomes mu d by d lambda. So in lambda mu space, the generators are all first order differential operators. which is a much more, which is a more elementary kind of representation of a symmetry group. It means that the generators act as symmetries of a space. So the space of which these operators are symmetries is just a four-dimensional space whose coordinates are lambda and mu. So we've got two lambdas and two mu's, so this space is a copy of C4. And on C4, we could take all the traceless 4x4 matrices. The traceless 4x4 matrices generate SL4. If we let them be complex, we'd get SL4C. To keep this lecture brief and simple, I'm not really imposing reality conditions, but the conformal group SU22, that's the conformal group in four dimensions, is a real form of SL4. We could also call it SO24. So we're not going to worry about the reality conditions, so we'll just think of the conformal group as being SL4. So the conformal group is just the group of all traceless 4x4 matrices acting on this four-dimensional space. That also leaves the identity matrix, but it means something too. You see, D became traceless. It had a plus sign, which turned into a minus sign when we went from lambda to mu. So D corresponds to this traceless matrix. And the constraint operator used to have a minus sign, but now it has a plus sign. The constraint operator becomes lambda I d by d lambda I plus mu I d by d mu I on A, except now it's a different A. It's A written in lambda mu space. Is something times A. Something that depends on the helicity. So the constraint tells us, if the helicity were zero, the constraint would simply tell us that the scattering amplitude would be homogeneous in lambda and mu. And being homogeneous in lambda and mu, it would really live not on C4, but on what's called CP3, which is the space of lambda and mu with an equivalence relation that lambda mu is equivalent to T lambda T mu for any non-zero complex number C. Lambda tilde, remember, scaled oppositely to lambda, but because mu was d by d lambda tilde, mu scales the same way as lambda. And that's why in lambda mu space, the constraint becomes the identity matrix. And the traceless matrices generate the conformal group, SL4. So when we consider a scattering amplitude for external gluons, well, first of all, what it means concretely, informally, but concretely, to write a scattering amplitude in lambda mu space is that we simply take a Fourier transform with respect to the lambda tildes. Given the traditional scattering amplitudes in lambda space, usually informally called scattering amplitudes in momentum space. We Fourier transform with respect to lambda tilde, and we land in lambda mu space. So we can think of scattering amplitudes as a function of lambda and mu, and each lambda and mu, because of the constraint, really should be understood as defining a point in CP3, not in C4. I should say that C4 is Penrose's twister space, and CP3 is projective twister space. When we calculate a scattering amplitude, we might think of CP3 and a lot of points in it, one for each external particle. And now we'd like to ask what Yang-Mills scattering amplitudes look like as a function of the homogeneous coordinates of CP3, labeling the external states. Any questions? Yes?
Can you be a little more precise on the exponential I left bracket lambda tilde mu?
Yes?
Right bracket, what is that?
Well, I defined it at the beginning. It was the Lorentz invariant inner product. No. Well, lambda tilde and lambda are in opposite spaces. If you look at the formulas, you'll see that lambda tilde and mu are in the same space. Right? The formulas only make sense if lambda tilde and mu transform the same way under the Lorentz group. So therefore, they've got a sensible inner product. Tony, did you have a question?
You emphasized all this conformal group.
Yes.
So does that mean when you turn on quantum fluctuation for the loop amplitude, you get in trouble with this formula?
I don't know. In my proposal, in my paper, I made a proposal for n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, which of course is quantum conformally invariant. But the evidence is that the one loop amplitudes without supersymmetry or conformal invariance have extremely similar properties, as has been shown in much more detail than in the paper. In the paper, there was just a naive comment, but in work with Peter Swercheck and Freddy Cachazzo, we've gone into a lot more detail. And although an explanation hasn't been found, pragmatically, it looks like there's at least some evidence that there's a similar story without conformal invariance or supersymmetry. I can only tell you what I know. I can't tell you what I don't know. That's probably true, because probably if you have bare masses, you won't get anything nice. At least not for the external mass of particles. Even there, though, I wouldn't assume that none of this survives. It's worth trying. The beauty, the gauge transformation is a scaling of lambda and mu. So all that's left of gauge invariance is that the amplitude obeys this constraint. So when I say that we're in CP3, we've imposed gauge equivalence. I'm hiding a lot of technicalities, a certain fraction of which you can read about in the paper, and the rest I don't understand. But at the level I'm presenting it today, I think it's fine, basically. Lambda and mu are, the wave function in lambda mu space is a gauge invariant observable. Well, let's carry out this Fourier transform for the simplest case of the MHV amplitudes. So, first we're going to write the delta function in a handy fashion. So, the amplitude, apart from some constant, the main thing is that we have an integral over x of e to the I x a dot times a sum over all particles of lambda lambda tilde. That's how we're going to write the delta function of energy momentum conservation. And the rest of the amplitude, it's given by this nice function of lambda. Actually, I'll define a function of lambda which includes the prefactor. So I'll get rid of this little bit and just write this as f of lambda. This is the scattering amplitude in lambda space. Now, what's the scattering amplitude in twister space, in lambda view space? Well, we're carrying a Fourier transform, so I write the exponential of I times lambda mu, and then we write the amplitude that's being transformed. The lambda tilde integrals are trivial to do, because lambda tilde only appears in the exponent where it only appears linearly. So the lambda tilde integrals just give us delta functions. And the amplitude, therefore, is an integral d4x, f of lambda, times a product for I equals 1 to n of a delta function setting mu a dot of the ith particle plus x a dot times lambda a of the ith particle to 0. Each particle has its own mu and its own lambda, but there's only one x that they share, because there only was one delta function of energy momentum conservation. Well, let's discuss what this means. So first, let's just look at this equation, mu a dot plus x a dot lambda a equals 0. Well, we have four variables, lambda and mu. We could combine them into z a, where a runs from 1 to 4. These are equations that set to 0 two linear combinations of the z's. And conversely, any generic set of two equations setting to 0 two linear combinations can be written like that. We could have had a more general set of equations. Let's say alpha a z a equals 0 and beta a z a equals 0, where alpha a and beta a are arbitrary coefficients. Generically, if a certain determinant is non-zero, you can solve the equations for mu. And these are equivalent to these more general equations after solving for mu, which we can always do generically. So the generic condition setting a linear, two linear combinations of lambda mu to 0 is of that form for some x. And all of them are of that form where we include points at x equals infinity. Now, if we look at this in CP3, well, first of all, in C4, this equation defines a C2 in C4. It says we can solve for mu in terms of the lambdas, so the space of solutions has lambdas as coordinates, and there are two of them, so they parameterize C2. In CP3, the lambdas become homogeneous coordinates, and the solution set, which I'll call E of that equation, is a copy of CP1 inside CP3. It's a CP1 because since you can solve for the mu in terms of lambdas, it's parameterized by homogeneous coordinates, by the lambdas as homogeneous coordinates. There are two of them, and so the space with those homogeneous coordinates is a copy of CP1. So what I've explained to you is that this equation defines a CP1 and CP3, and except for some cases where x is infinity, that's the space of all the CP1s in CP3. Well, all the linearly embedded CP1s. So these are all the holomorphic curves of degree 1. to use that language. If we were doing world sheet instantons in string theory, the basic string instantons of degree one would be these. So the integral, so x labels a point in the moduli space of instantons of degree one in CP3. So the integral d4x is an integral over the moduli space. Which we'll call M. Then we've got these delta functions. The delta functions simply say that each of the external gluons lies on a given instanton for some value of x. So we pick our endpoints in CP3, but if they're scattered like that, the amplitude is zero. The amplitude is only non-zero if there's actually a CP1 that contains all our gluons. And if there is such an instanton, then the amplitude is given by f of lambda, which was a simple holomorphic function of lambda, which can essentially be interpreted, as Nair did about 16 years ago, in terms of a correlation functions of fermion currents on CP1.
How does Nair guess
that? Well, he didn't have mu and lambda, but he had lambda and lambda tilde. Well, the numerator comes from supersymmetrizing it. I'm cheating a little bit. If we did this in a manifestly supersymmetric way, we wouldn't have the numerator. And the denominator, this is written in a different language, but the usual formula, for a free fermion correlation function on the complex plane is this, which in a more covariant language turns into that. So Nair noticed that that formula was an endpoint function of fermion currents on CP1. He didn't have the CP3 in which the CP1 lied. So it was hard, possibly, to state the generalization that I'm about to propose. My generalization is that, you see, this is the amplitude with almost all pluses. And just two minuses. Now, let's consider an amplitude with p pluses and q minuses. Well, my proposal is that you have to replace the moduli space of instantons of degree 1 by the moduli space of instantons of degree q minus 1 and gene is 0 if we want tree amplitudes. Or in general, genus equal to or less than L, which is the number of loops. And basically, I don't want to describe a lot of technical details, but basically, my proposal for the tree amplitudes in twister space is that they're given by an integral over curves of the appropriate degree in CP3, where f of lambda is replaced by the corresponding free fermion correlation function on that curve. Now, there are two main things that I haven't told you that are in the paper. So, section 3 begins with things I have told you, but then it goes on to try to give evidence for this proposal. The evidence is given by showing Okay. The claim, okay. My claim is that if these points are randomly distributed, the amplitude is zero. For it to be non-zero, the points have to lie on certain instantons. The condition that the points lie on certain instantons can be expressed as some equations for their homogeneous coordinates, lambda and mu, that have to be satisfied. If I would know how to Fourier transform the scattering amplitudes, as we did explicitly for the MHV case, I would just check if it the Fourier transforms had those delta functions. But since I didn't know that, what I did instead, I took the equations that were supposed to be obeyed, which said that the points lie on an instanton. It's a wobbly instanton because the degree is bigger than one. Okay. So this is meant as a completely arbitrary notation for an instanton of degree two. I didn't know how to draw it, so I drew something that wobbled a little bit. So I could write down some equations on the homogeneous coordinates of n points that say that they're all contained in a curve of degree two. So we get some function f of lambda and mu that vanishes. Actually, it's a bunch of functions that should all vanish. And those equations say that the amplitude vanishes, that the points all lie on a suitable curve. But I can evaluate this without actually going to twister space. In terms of lambda and lambda tilde, the statement means that a certain differential equation is obeyed by the original amplitude. So the part of section 3 that I didn't tell you about, which is most of it, is devoted to constructing in a number of examples these these polynomials whose vanishing is asserted by the conjecture, then rewriting them as differential equations and showing that the standard Yang-Mills scattering amplitudes in the spinner formalism obey them. And a lot of that worked, so I went on in section 4 and tried to make a string theory proposal, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a moment. Now, since the paper was written with Cacciazzo and Svercek, we've done a lot more of this. That is, we've studied a lot of amplitudes in a lot more detail than is in the paper, including a lot more on one-loop amplitudes, non-supersymmetric amplitudes, and general relativity. And they all obey differential equations that are definitely in the spirit proposed in the paper. But there are some details that aren't understood, where the equations that we actually find empirically don't match what I would have guessed based on the string theory proposal in section 4. There actually is an example of this in the paper. Something happened in section 3 that I couldn't understand. So I just gave a lame excuse that you can find if you read closely and went on. But we found a lot more examples of this.
Is this where the beginning of the big model is that you're mapping?
Well, we're about to get there in section 4 where I tried to make a string theory proposal. So, yes?
Is it true that the empirical evidence is always better than you would have expected?
Well, for a while it was true, and therefore I wasn't too unhappy. I felt something good would happen later. But eventually we found out that, at first we were always getting extra equations not explained by the string theory. But eventually we found that some equations that seemed to be suggested by the string theory were missing, leading me to say somewhat lamely, well, one hypothesis is that the string theory proposal isn't quite right, but I don't know another one that makes any sense, unfortunately. Another possibility is that it is right, but there's something oversimplified about how one's tried to calculate with it. I don't know. What section 4 consists of is a proposal about what string theory would actually generate this. So, well, the way I presented this, we have the ZAs, the homogeneous coordinates, lambda and mu. But if we were supersymmetrizing this, we'd have ZAs as well as some fermions that we might call psi I, where I runs from 1 to n, which is the number of supersymmetries. And if we interpret these as homogeneous coordinates, we would have landed in not in CP3, but in what's called CP3/n, with fermionic as well as bosonic homogeneous coordinates. Well, something funny happens to us here, which is that precisely if n is 4, CP3/n becomes a Clavial supermanifold. CP3/4 is actually a Calabi-Yau supermanifold. You could argue that it's much simpler, in a sense, than bosonic Calabi-Yaus, because you know the Calabi-Yau metric in closed form. It's given by the standard expression for the metric of CP3, extended to include fermions as well as bosons, except that it's Ricci flat in the case that the number of homogeneous bosons equals the number of homogeneous fermions. Since it's a Calabi-Yau supermanifold, it has something called, you can make a topological field theory called the B model. The B model is a topological field theory with, in this case, CP3/4 as target. We can't do this unless the number of supersymmetries is 4, because CP3/n wouldn't be Calabi-Yau. So I feel this is perhaps dual to the fact that n equals 4 super Young Mills is only conformally invariant for n equals 4. I should have expressed that poorly. Super Young Mills is only conformally invariant for n equals 4. So then I looked at this model in, I tried to use the standard B model. Well, I introduced some D-brains in modern language, space-filling D-brains. And then I showed, by reinterpreting a very elegant construction found by Penrose almost 30 years ago, I showed that the spectrum of the B model was the vector multiplet of n equals 4 super Young Mills. That's actually true. That's one assertion in the paper I'm sure of. Not expressed in this language. He expressed it that the space of solutions of the massless wave equation is given by some sheaf cohomology group of CP3. But modulo standard facts about the B model and so on, Penrose's assertion is equivalent to what I said. So, okay. The only trouble with this was that, the long and short of it is that I wanted to get the scattering amplitudes from instanton corrections to the B model, but the claim to fame of the B model is that it doesn't have world sheet instantons. So eventually, after pondering that for a long time, I decided to use D instantons instead of world sheet instantons. A heuristic motivation is given by heterotic type 1 duality. The B model, with D brains included, is a kind of type 1 model, and it doesn't have world sheet instanton corrections. But it might have a heterotic string dual for some values of the gauge group, maybe. I don't know if it does. I don't know what it is. But if it had a heterotic string dual, we'd expect it would have world sheet instantons, as the heterotic string usually does, that contribute to chiral correlation functions. And then under heterotic type 1 duality, those would turn into D1 brains. So when I tried using D1 brain instantons, I found it was actually no trouble at all that, well, this amplitude interpreted a la Nair popped out from the one instanton contribution. You can read about that in section 4 along with a lot of other funny things. But computations haven't yet been successfully done for degree bigger than 1. And there are all kinds of puzzles about it, some of which are explained in the paper. So I think it's a reasonable place to stop, maybe. Yes? About loops? Well, one thing I can tell you is that the loop corrections, I don't know the proper string theory method of calculation, but the loop corrections do obey differential equations that are similar to get what I guessed in the paper. They're not exactly right.
That's, I mean, one of the confusing aspects that you touch a bit on.
Yes?
Bread singularity, your own shell, that's the
problem. Yes.
So things on the gauge theory side are often singular. And obviously, one of the regulators of the
ring. Well, in degree 2, which would be the first case, for the one loop MHV amplitudes, the instantons turn out to have degree 2. And there are two cases, connected and disconnected. And, well, nothing's happened since the paper that would make me retract my proposal that the degree 2, sorry, the disconnected contribution is the very simple one that's usually written as the first term by Dixon, Vernon Kossauer, and that's the infrared singular term. So in this language, you iterate over the positions of the two instantons, and that's where the infrared singularity comes from. That's a very simple term. The complexity with all the dial algorithms and such comes presumably from this amplitude. And the one loop MHV amplitude. Well, after all, it shouldn't be too much of a shock because the infrared singularities are connected with unitarity, intermediate physical states. So if the basic scattering amplitude comes from one of these, the infrared divergent part should come from two of them. And that matches in the following sense. If you just look at the way the amplitude is usually written by Byrne, Kossauer, and Dixon, here I'm about to, well, reveal my, I think more forgetfulness than confusion, but anyway, there's the tree amplitude times 1 over epsilon squared times something that involves logarithms. What? Ratios of logarithms? What? Sorry. Okay. You're right. Okay. Something more like that. So that's infrared divergence. But when you expand it, it has a finite piece that has logarithms, squares of logarithms, in fact. So, well, this finite piece actually obeys the right equations to come from two disconnected CP1s. That appears to be true. It's actually something I found in the paper, and our subsequent work didn't lead to any revision of that. That seems to hold up for the n particle amplitudes at one loop. The rest of the amplitude, which is extremely complicated, well, I don't know if extremely complicated is the right word. It uses more advanced functions like dial logarithms. As a one loop amplitude, I guess it's simple. I'm not sure what's the correct way to characterize it. Anyway, it's more work to understand it. That's neutral.
My question is about the 1 over epsilon, log epsilon, log epsilon.
Okay, I see.
Which I can't discuss without a
label. Well, I can't discuss it either. But I would wonder. This isn't what I said in the paper, actually. But I would wonder if the integral doesn't, well, okay. I can't tell you anything sensible. That's the most honest I can be. I think I should stick with that. It comes from here, but I don't know what to say about it. I should quit while I'm ahead. I'm as close to being ahead as at this point as I'm going to be. and the rest of the amplitude with the dial logarithms, it obeys differential equations, which are cousins of what you'd have expected from this picture, but they're a little bit more complicated. Tony?
This is very, very vague, so I'm not even sure that I can formulate this as a question. What you've done reminded me, it seems to me I can say it, what you've done for the momentum variable, what Verhoef did for the color variable. So there's some kind of double line form. Can you, so this sort of suggests that there's something
Well, this is a topological B model, and there's Dykraff and Vafa who always love to turn topological B models into matrix models. But beyond that, I don't know what to tell you.
One question. Okay, well, let's try and get it.